Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, you little piglets. Gather around and suck oink, all oink. At our teats. talking, of course, about our podcasting teats.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, it's not gross that way.
We are doing some definitive teat suckling this week on film franchise Fortnite on the Cold Popshire podcast. I'm AJ, recording this from my new apartment. A little understated storyline of the last few months of the podcast was me looking for an apartment. Finally found one. And Richard, what do you think from what you can see of it on the Zoom call?
From what I can see of it on the Zoom call, you look like you're in a hotel room.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like a hotel room. I'm in a very cool city apartment that would overlook the city if there wasn't another city apartment building directly outside it. So I've got to sort of like stand and like skirt my head over the edge of the balcony by a couple of inches to get a good city view. But I also feel like that's a very AJ core compromise for, you know, I have a view technically.
Do you have any beautiful neighbors who live across the way and you can peek into their apartment? And it's not like in a pervy way, just like in a, you know, a romantic way.
Yeah, I'm peeking at my neighbors romantically. They don't know it, but it's romantic because Richard, I'm a bloody dog. I'm a bloody pig and I'm in the city, Richard, and I'm not the only one this week on Film Franchise Fortnite. Two Film, Two Franchise, because we are going to be covering, discussing, talking about the two films in the Babe series, Babe and Babe, Pig in the City. My Letterboxd review was very nearly "you and me both, brother," but I didn't think me moving into the apartment
people
was enough.
Wouldn't be able to infer that you're in the city.
Yeah. And then the very clever wordplay would have been lost. So before we get into the episode today, I do just want to let people know that I guest starred on the second most recent episode of Do Go On, where I talked about the process of getting a Dune film made. So if you enjoyed our episode last fortnight with Matt Stewart and you'd like to hear me and Matt and Jess Perkins and Dave Warnicky talk about something else, here on over to Do Go On and listen to the Dune, the unfilmable novel episode. I put together a little report and told them all about Dune, Hodorowski's Dune, David Lynch's Dune, Denis Villeneuve's Dune. We talked about it and it was a lot of fun, and I'd love for people to go listen to it if you weren't aware of it already.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard.
So two films. First one came out in 1995, followed in 1998. And first film. Let's dive right into it like a pig suckling at their mother's teat. And
Or a trough, a pig eating gruel
eating
out of a
slop out of a trough. Yeah, gather
slop
around
is
our,
the word I was looking
gather
for.
Gather around our trough and get your slop on. It's time to podcast. Yeah, directed by Chris Noonan. Do you recognize the name Chris Noonan?
Is Chris Noonan an actor or am I thinking of someone else?
I think you're thinking of someone else and I know who you're thinking of.
I'm thinking of Tom Noonan.
Yeah.
Tom Noonan.
Or you might be thinking of and his brother.
This is not the first time we've mentioned on this podcast and we have to bleep it because he's not a celebrity. He's just a person we know and you guys have as much information that his surname's Noonan as well. We can't bleep the whole thing because the whole point of going on this tangent was the surname. So
But
sorry if you're being doxxed by us.
But other than that, do you recognize the name Chris Noonan any of his other films or anything?
I don't think so.
No, he's only made one other film, Miss Potter. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't sound very familiar.
It's that you'll recognize the poster. It's like it's just like Renee Zellweger in like a period outfit going like,
Yeah, yeah. It's about the woman who wrote
Beatrix
Peter Rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, according to the very little I know about the behind the scenes of this film as well, he probably didn't even direct this one either. So, he's only directed one film about farm animals.
Were you a big Beatrix Potter guy?
No, not really. I think I was very into rabbits when I was a little kid. They were my favourite animal. But I think the sheer boringness of the Peter Rabbit illustrations overrode any interest I had in cute bunny rabbits.
Yeah, yeah. A Brer Rabbit...
And then James Corden did not help when he showed up on the scene to revitalise the franchise.
Yeah, I was into Brer Rabbit. You into Brer Rabbit?
How was... No idea who that is. Heard the name, though.
Yeah, he was great. Anyway, so the... Yeah, we'll get into some behind-the-scenes stuff in a moment. But yeah, it was written by Noonan and George Miller, who we've covered a couple of times on this podcast before. He directed all four Mad Max films, and he also, a lot more in line with this, directed both Happy Feet films.
A true testament to not being put in a box as a director, I think, George Miller. I reckon he's one of the most high-profile directors whose filmography varies wildly in tone and, even the R-rated Spielberg films and the G-rated Spielberg films still feel like Spielberg.
Yeah, they got that magic. I think there is still a Millerian quality to his films, though.
Absolutely.
More than anything, his camera work. Like, even, you know, like Witches of Eastwick and stuff, you get Lorenzo Zoyle.
I actually haven't seen either of those. I've only seen his franchise films.
Wow. Yeah, I
didn't even see A Thousand Years of Longing.
Yeah,
which
I was
I'd
so excited for
to.
That. And then I was in the States when it came out, and then I just didn't end up seeing it. Anywho, the film's based on a novel, fans of our intern Rachel will be happy to know that we did renew her contract for this year. And so, they have sent me through a list of differences between the book and the film, which we'll get to in a moment. However, fans of our other intern, Vincent, who would play video games and review tie-in video games, his contract was not renewed because... we cancelled the show that he would do that for.
Don't know. Are there Babe video games?
There is. I was going to get to it at the end, but there is a universally panned Babe Pig in the City game from 2006.
I love that. Yeah. Universally panned.
The book was called The Sheep Pig. If you're in the US, you might know it as Babe, The Gallant Pig, which is what it was called there.
None of these are doing it for me.
Yeah.
Sheep Pig I can understand, but Babe, I guess maybe it's because I've grown up with knowing the film's called Babe, like just feels irreplaceable to me.
What is Babe about, AJ?
Well, it's about a gallant sheep pig, Richard. I'm so glad you've asked. No, Babe is set on what they're trying to sell as like a quaint American... Is it American or English?
I'd say...
Because it's really Australian, I know that much.
New South Wales,
they've done their best to dress up Australia as some kind of country town in possibly England or America. I would have said England if I hadn't watched the film, but watching it, everyone... Like, there's a lot of American accents going on.
Yeah, so there's also, to be... I think we'll get to this when we get to the second film, but I think it's intentionally... ambiguous where it is, especially when we get to the city.
That's true.
We'll discuss what city it is in a moment, because normally you'd go, he goes to the city. But anyway, AJ, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
No, so
don't let me interrupt
me
interrupt you.
I'm trying.
Just keep going.
I'm trying so hard.
Going.
We lay our scene in Fair Hoggett Farm, where James Cromwell plays a farmer named Hoggett, and he's got a wife who's played by the lady from Kath and Kim, who's about 20 years older.
Megha Savansky.
Yeah, her. She's about 20 years older in this than she was in real life, by the looks of it.
Yeah, she was like 33 in the film.
Mm, there you go. Well, she looks about 63 in the film. So,
which is 20 years older, yeah.
This farm, they're a sheep farm, and one day they get a little piglet that they plan to cook up for the Christmas dinner at the end of the year, but the pig shows a penchant for sheep dogging, for herding sheep,
and
is quite good at it. Yep, and so the farmer decides to actually invest in this sheep and train it to be a really good sheepdog. That's pretty much the film. It's very quaint. Oh, by the way, the animals can speak, but only to other animals. They can't speak. The humans can't understand. It's always interesting to see what rules will this talking animal movie go by. Mm. And this is the type of talking animal genre where every animal that's not a human can understand each other. They speak some kind of universal language cross species, but the humans just hear oinking and barking and grunting.
Yeah, it is. This film is kind of credited with kicking off the CGI talking animal craze, because it was quite well received. Do you want to take a guess as to what it has on Rotten Tomatoes?
I'm thinking like 85% on Rotten Tomatoes.
No, you dumb fuck. It's actually 97%.
Very high for a movie. Had you seen this before?
I'd never seen Babe before, no.
So I would have thought I had, but watching it, I was like, I reckon this was like the Colgate Saturday Night feature once or twice when I was a kid. And I remember That'll Do Pig. And I
that's
remember
just one
like
of those things that's just seeped into. I've just picked out it from pop culture osmosis. It's just into the public consciousness. But yeah, I mean, like, surprisingly for this kind of film, so this was like just a nice family film, you would think, you know, nothing necessarily to write home about, but yeah, it was beloved. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. It won Best Visual Effects. It was also nominated for Best Editing, Art Direction, Adapted Screenplay, Supporting Actor, Director, and Best Picture. And this was back in 1995, where there were only 5 Best Picture nominees. I'll pull up what it was up against.
Yeah, so isn't this I found out this was nominated for Best Picture a couple of weeks back, and I was like, is this like the most appropriate for all ages movie to have ever been nominated for Best Picture?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't say it's squeaky clean. There's a bit of like it deals with death, but it deals with death in a very mature and like a way that I don't think would be too outside the realms of what kids probably already know about death. But this movie's like, this is such a dark horse for Best Picture, I think. What was it up against?
It was up against, it lost to Braveheart. It was up against Apollo 13, okay. Il Postino, and Sense and Sensibility. Some other films from that year, Leaving Las Vegas, Bridges of Madison County, Usual Suspects.
Leaving Las Vegas didn't get nominated for Best Picture.
Toy Story as well. Well, there was only 5 nominees at the time, so.
But that's even more surprising, because this feels like the kind of film that gets nominated for Best Picture because you've extended it to 10.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Not, but I also wonder though if this is actually a situation where we are underestimating the cultural phenomenon that Babe would have been in 95, right? Like, this would have been 95's Barbie, right? Like, this this really bright, exciting, interesting, must-see film that, in the case of Babe, it has this groundbreaking special effects in it. Like, this is like a Best Picture nomination that feels like it's acknowledging that something that new has been the added forward. To the film.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I looked to compare like that 7 Oscar mark, nomination mark. You know, that's equivalent to Maestro this year or The Fablemans last year.
Right, yeah. I'd say it's. So, I'd put it in the same.
And actually, interestingly, Belfast the year before. So the last 3 years of like director vanity projects all get 7 nominations.
Amazing. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, what did you think of Babe?
I watched Babe in two halves, and it was one of those films that I think really won me over in the second part that I watched it. Because the first half, I was like, yep, talking animals, haven't fucking seen that before. And
it's very vignette-y. Like, it's very, like, fade to black, the mice come up, they introduce the next story, and it feels like what I was to understand the Stuart Little book was like.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like just sort of independent
They
episodes.
Wanted to keep it that sort of storybook feel, and the mice popping up to tell you the name of the chapter is because in test screenings, George Miller noticed that kids were having to be like, what does it say? And then so they add unintelligible fucking mice. But also, you might be about to say this, but on my screening on Amazon Prime, did yours just not have the words?
I think it did have the words. I wasn't about to say that. I was about to say
were they in black? Because it didn't have a heading. It just had the mice saying it in the second one.
I don't remember. But I do. I can tell you that I some months ago edited a video for Letterboxd that was the guys that directed Talk to Me interviewing George Miller, and he said that I might be paraphrasing or misremembering it exactly. Apparently, this was a mess in the edit, and that George Miller's wife was the one that said, what about these mice? Like, what if they segment it? And that's one of these, like, that saved the film, kind of. And I think she still edits for him. Like, I think she's still his main editor. So not that he directed this. Let's be very clear. This was Chris Noonan's film.
Yeah, so there, as you alluded to earlier, there's a little bit of controversy. Actually, no, you know what? I'm going to finish talking about what I thought of the film first. Because, so the first half of the film was a bit like, whatever. It's nice. Best picture? Okay. And then when we get to the sheepdog trial at the end, and spoilers for Babe, Babe wins the trial by being nice and kind, because it's like the whole thing is like it's a universally regarded truth that sheep are stupid and the dogs have to come in and just bark the shit out of them to get them to do anything.
And bite at them and nip them.
Yeah, and Babe just says, Babe gets the password that's like a secret sheep password because the sheep want to help Babe. And it's this all like it's that sort of very what's now very in vogue thing of like solving problems with kindness, you know, that we've seen, you know, the Good Place, Ted Lasso, that it's like it's the hot thing in comedy right now. And when he actually does the trial, the score completely drops out. There's no music in the scene. You can hear a pin drop because the whole thing is, you know, he's bringing a pig out to a sheepdog trial, and
he's the laughingstock of the entire country of
and everyone's cracking up. But then as soon as Babe actually starts doing it, the music drops, the entire crowd is completely silent, and then it's like part of the trial is like you have to get 6 sheep into the circle, and then you take like 3 of them out, so you divide them, so you know, shows real control. And then he does it in like record time, and as soon as he's done, the crowd just fucking erupts, goes insane from being like completely deathly silent. And then of course, the iconic line where Babe goes and stands by the farmer's side and says, and he says, "That'll do, pig. That'll do." And that's it's one of these, like, I've never really understood that line, and I'm kind of still don't. Like, I get that it's like he's a very closed off character, and I guess it's just his way of saying good job, you know. Because that'll do is like not a very encouraging thing to say to someone, but I guess within the context of the character, that's the whole point.
He's got that Cromwellian warmth that can turn anything into a loving line, I think.
And yeah, so it's great. We've had this a few times on the podcast, but like when you see an iconic moment and you're like, yes, I get this now. This is why it's iconic.
Yeah, nice. I think that one of the things I loved about it, I gave this 5 stars, was not expecting to, but gave 5 stars on Letterboxd. And I think that what I loved about it is that not only does it is it broadly dealing with bigotry, I guess, your assumptions about another group of people, quote unquote, and you know, there's this really clever
you don't see them as people, AJ. That's pretty fucking racist.
There's this really clever bit where they say the thing you said before, that it's a universally regarded fact that sheep are stupid, and that's why the dog was talking slowly to the sheep to try and save Babe. But then when the sheep talked to the dog, it was like, it's a universally regarded fact that, what was it, dogs don't listen or something that. So it's like this that goes the same way, and they come to an understanding. So not only does it tackle bigotry in a quaint old-timey way that just points out how stupid it is to and how bogged down and how of a roadblock bigotry can be in solving a problem, right? But I also really liked that it follows this thread where it doesn't shy away from the fact that humans eat animals, and nowhere in the I always felt in The Lion King, right, where they're like, oh no, when we eat the antelope, they return to the grass, and then when we die, we return to the grass, and they eat the grass. So it's the circle of life, and it's like, oh great, Mufasa, of course you would say that as the one that gets to kill the antelope and eat them. You'd be like, yeah, don't worry, antelope, we'll die, and then your ancestors will eat the grass. It's like, yeah, well, someone's getting a raw deal in that. I always felt like that was such a privileged way to put it when you're the predator. But in Babe, they don't shy away from that. And when Babe finds out that he was initially supposed to be eaten, it's heartbreaking. And this is I felt this was a pro-vegetarian film. Because at no point does it ever justify eating other animals. Yep. I guess in real life, animals aren't as cogent as they are in the universe.
Well, apparently so. Babe.
Apparently so. But you know, it wasn't a movie that tried to have its cake and eat it too by saying we'll brush over the fact that a lot of these animals get eaten by humans. It's like, nope, let's deal with it. Let's tell kids about it. And let's not really offer a satisfying conclusion to it beyond just acceptance that that's the way the world is.
I think George Miller's a vegetarian, and James Cromwell was a vegetarian and became vegan because of starring in this film, and essentially was I can't ethically be in this film and still eat animal products. And apparently pork sales in the US dropped by 20% after the movie came out, and it's had a market effect on the growth of vegetarianism, apparently.
That's awesome. And good. It should have, because I'm a vegetarian at all but my willpower only, I think, at this stage of my life. And just to be clear, I'm not a vegetarian, but I would like to be.
Yeah, that's the thing. I love animals so much that I'm it's one of those things that, you know, if a vegan or a vegetarian stopped me and questioned me on it, it's like, there is no reason I can give you. It's to justify to you or to myself, I'm just a shitty person with shitty taste buds. But it's like I have to have that cognitive dissonance, because I find every animal so cute that it's like I'm not even you know, there's a difference between cats and dogs and a cow or something. I find cows adorable. I used to go at my old flat. There was, especially during COVID, there was this park, Cornwall Park, in Auckland.
Oh, I think Cromwell Park. Yeah. Well. Any relation?
that would, and they would have just like cows and quite often sheep like roaming around there. And I would always like so excitedly take photos of heaps of them. They would like come right up to you. And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you're in their space, so be careful. But I would like hang out with the cows, and like, I think chickens are cute. I think ducks are fucking cute. I would love a pet duck, but my two cats, I think, would probably not love that. But yeah, it's
I think they would love it. You just wouldn't have a pet duck for very long after. Yeah,
but there is my sort of that side of my beliefs does eat into my feelings about the second film. We'll get to that, I'm sure. But yeah,
well, I would say as well, like pigs especially, and Babe obviously being a pig. Who voices Babe? It's Tommy Pickles, right?
In the second film, it's Tommy Pickles. In the first film, it's Susie Carmichael.
That's right, it is too. Just the cutest voice, so well characterized.
Christine Cavanagh is the actress's name.
Yes, that's right. But on top of that, like pigs, of all the animals we do eat, pigs are the ones that need to be pushed into the cats and dogs bracket of do not eat more. Like, I hate to put a value on it, and maybe that's also like a very short-sighted thing to say, but like pigs are intelligent, and
they can herd sheep.
And like, they can herd sheep. Have you seen
Babe? They orgasm for 30 minutes.
What kind of creature would be, is not, you know, if they're orgasming for 30 minutes, that is the sure sign of intelligence.
Mm. They're just cute, man. Pigs are cute. They grow fucking fast. There were 48 piglets used for Babe because they grow so fast.
Oh my god. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
48. Yeah. Holy shit.
There was a pub quiz question at a Quiz Jess was at recently. It was like, which 1995 film had 50 of its extras die within a year of the film's release?
Oh, that's such a depressing way to put it.
Yeah, but it's like, well, they're animals, so that, you know, a lot of them have short lifespans. And also, you know, would have been killed for meat.
Ah, right. Not just the pigs, then. It's not just the 48 pigs.
No, no. I
get what you mean. I thought you were meaning like the 48 pigs were all slaughtered after, which is like George Miller. Surely you could have done something about Chris Noonan. Surely you could have done something about this. My favorite aspect of Babe, the film, was James Cromwell, was Farmer Hoggett. I thought he was such a, like, I knew That'll Do Pig, I knew it was James Cromwell, but I did not know how layered and complex this character was before watching it here, because he is so reserved and keeps his feelings so close to his chest that when things like That'll Do Pig or similar moments throughout the film, it feels like the equivalent of him like bursting into tears, pouring his heart out, because it's so, It's like that's how he knows, that's how capable he is of showing his emotions. And there's this one bit in the film where Babe has been out all night after he discovered that he was supposed to be eaten. And he's got a cold, and Hoggett has got to like heal him up and get him drinking fluid so that he can still do the sheepdogging competition. And he does it. He slowly like starts singing to him. And what do you have the name of the song? Because it's the score for the film as well.
Yeah, I can pull it up for you 1 second. If I had words, I think
it's if I had words. Da, 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 da. And he sings that, and then he gets up and starts dancing, and all the animals like turn and watch him, and he feels a little bit embarrassed, feels a little bit sheepish after that, Richard. And what I loved
feels
is like
a little bit dogged.
So much of this character is like left for you to decipher, and it's like what that scene tells you when he does this like Irish jig to this wonderful, wonderful song. It spoke to me because it's like he would not do this in front of humans. He wouldn't even do this in front of his wife. Like the Babe means so more, pig as he calls him, means so much to him that that's who he's willing to be his true Salve, isn't that beautiful? isn't that such beautiful character writing and performance? Like, I didn't know that that was hidden in Babe. Mm. I didn't know that there was this beautiful human story that's, like, very much secondary to the wacky talking duck and the evil cat. Like, you know, like, oh, by the way, there's this really touching depiction of, like, sort of like a masculine character who grew up in a time where he would have been taught to not display his emotions, finding a way to... I'm choking up talking about it. I thought it was really touching. A really touching portrayal.
Well, I mean, he was nominated for an Oscar for it, for the supporting actor, and...
He should have been, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was, so...
Great. Well, I'm happy then.
Yeah, good. But he originally didn't want to do the role. Well, George Miller wanted an Australian, I guess because, you know, and Megan Sabansky is an Australian, so would have maybe been doing an accent, but I guess he just wanted to support local talent. But yeah, it was Noonan, I was going to say Tom Noonan, it was Noonan who insisted on him. But yeah, James Cromwell didn't want the role originally because he looked at the script and was like, this guy has 16 lines. The farmer says
right, so-
a total of 171 words across the film.
So the very thing I'm praising him for, he just didn't get off bat. He was just like,
But he said so that, funny. You know, and then like after looking into it more, was like, oh, I'm in every scene. I just don't speak a lot, you know. He was convinced by a friend who essentially said, look, you go to Australia, you have a little holiday, you make a picture. If the film fails, no one's blaming you. They're going to blame the pig. And so he was like, yeah, I guess, all right,
not
I'll
only
do
am
it.
I not blaming the pig, I'm actually spotlighting him as the best part of the of this groundbreaking visual effects masterpiece, this touching film about, like, animals. I'm saying, no, the animal that I was most drawn to, the human.
Wow. The one that you won't
I just
eat.
Found him more relatable.
Yeah.
I love how dark the film gets as well. We talked about this before, but, like,
how dark the film befriends, gets. Yeah, one of them's a main
how
character.
How dark it gets. There's a, like, a matriarchal sheep called Ma that is sort of takes Babe under her wing, and Ma is killed when a bunch of dogs of evil dogs break into the farm, and there's this bit where they're all crowded around the dead body of Ma, and Babe starts going Ma, 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 and the camera, like, pans up, like, in, like, a bird's eye view of this pig, like, crying to the heavens, and the dark joke here is that it's the sound a sheep makes, and all the sheep are crying and bleating with them. Like, this is fucking You're Tearing Me Apart, Lisa. What's that guy's name?
Tommy Wiseau.
The original one. James. That's a James Dean, like, you know? Like, that's what that reminded me of. Or Marlon Brando yelling Stella and Streetcar Named Desire. Like obviously it's evoking similar imagery, and it's directly
or like, referencing it. Or like Darth Vader going no and Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, man. Like, it's just a
it's
genuine
same,
moment of drama where this happens plenty in the film, and this is why it's so good. But in that moment specifically, it doesn't matter that it's one of 48 pigs that's got its mouth CGI'd to move and speak and sounds like
also
Susie Carmichael. Like, it's just a really, really impactful character moment.
Yeah, there's also a lot of... There's the CGI mouths, and you know, it's technology that's gotten a lot better at the time, but it was groundbreaking for the time, but it still looks great. But there's also some, like, fucking phenomenal animatronics being used.
Mm.
And seamlessly Henson, like, real pigs, and yeah, it's great.
The Jim Henson Company was on this, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But yeah, so we'll talk about it. So yeah, Chris Noonan directed this film but didn't direct the sequel. George Miller took over, and there was supposedly some bad blood between them. James Cromwell, as recently as like 2020, has talked about how they clashed quite a bit on set. Some quotes about it. Noonan said, look, I don't want to make a lifelong enemy out of George Miller, but I thought that he tried to take credit for babe, tried to exclude me from any credit, and it made me very insecure. It was like your guru has told you that you are no good, and that is really disconcerting. George Miller later replied, in the trades, being like, Chris said something that is defamatory, that I took his name off the credits on internet sites, which is absolutely untrue. You know, I'm sorry, but I really have a lot more to do with my life than worry about that. When it comes to Babe, the vision was handed to Chris on a plate.
Interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. Because, like, I am growing very, very fond of George Miller as a director, despite only having seen that handful of films. But, like, watching what we're about to talk about, Babe, Pig in the City, just, like, I think he's such a pro. And Babe 1 is the movie it needs to be. And maybe that's because George Miller wasn't directing it. Because once he got his hands on the franchise for the sequel, I think we get maybe one of the most interesting to talk about sequels we've ever covered on this show. You know?
Yeah. Well, we do have one little bit to get to before we move on. I'm not talking about franchise. That segment's been all but abandoned. I'm talking about intern Rachel and their list of differences from the book to the movie. So
let me hear it.
The one of the sort of primary things, the film opens with Babe's kind of backstory and the original farm that he gets taken from. None of that's in the book. The Rex, the dog, Ferdinand, Duchess, the cow, and the horse are not in the book. The book actually specifically says the farm hasn't had horses for a long time, but I guess it's more cinematic to have a whole litany of animals. There is
Rex isn't in the book.
Yeah,
that's a he's a massive. That's the male sheepdog. Yeah, voiced right? by Hugo Weaving. Massive part of the story.
There's Hoggett grows protective of Babe pretty quickly, and it's sort of their kinship's a little bit faster in the book. I talked about how I love how Babe gets his way in the sheepdog trials by being polite, but in the movie he originally tries to bark at them and then learns that, you know, there's a better way around this. In the book he's only ever polite, so that was added as like an arc, I guess, interestingly.
Well, it's like the Paddington thing, right? Where it's a character has a non-arc because Babe goes into the story being like, I'm just going to be polite because that's who I am. Yeah. Then the dogs go, no, you have to be rough. So he tries it, doesn't work, goes back to being polite. And it's actually a story about how like the character's journey is far less compared to like the lesson that the main character teaches those around him, I guess.
So there's you mentioned about the Rex being missing as well. So in the book it's Fly, the female who wanted to win the trials but was never able to. In the movie, Rex is like a 2-time champion. There's like the drowned sheep, the hearing loss, all of that. None of that's in the book. That was all for the movie.
It's great stuff. The movie sounds way better than the book. That's what I'm getting from this.
Yeah, and also I mentioned what's the password for the sheep?
Baramu.
Yeah.
Baramu, which I never understood till this watch because I'd heard that before, is bar, the noise of sheep. I got that bit. Yeah. Then ram you.
Yeah.
Never separated the made up bullshit word enough in my mind before to realize it's bar ram you. Spirits, sheeps be true, something or other. Do you have it in front of you?
No, it's so interesting. So you're saying bar ram you, but I just want you to take it one step further and clarify what your realization is.
Oh, that rams and ewes are animals.
Yeah, right. Yeah, male and female sheep.
I just thought it was like, woo, spooky.
Because when you said I thought your realization was that it's like bar meaning sheep, they're gonna ram you, like they're gonna no, knock you down. I thought that was your big realization just then, the way you said it.
No, I think when I was a kid and heard it, I just thought it was like made up sheep gibberish. Bar ram you, right? But what's the full password? Do you have it? Oh, sorry, I thought you were about to read it.
I was about to read the one from the book.
Oh, yeah. What's the one in the book?
Yeah, so in the book, the password is, I may be you, I may be ram, I may be mutton, may be lamb, but on the hoof or on the hook, I baint so stupid as I look. And Rachel has clarified, no, baint is not a typo.
What? Is it because B-A is the first two letters of bar? Is
yeah, it must be. I banked, so...
Okay, banked. Yeah, all right, okay. If you pronounce it right, it sounds good. If not, it just sounds like the most, like, far-reached, like grasping at straws kind of pun.
Yeah. So, as always, I will ask Rachel to pop this whole list of comparisons in the Discord, so you can check out all the ones that I skimmed over there, or if you enjoyed the ones I read so much you want to read them for yourself, you can also do that. So yeah, 1998, George Miller brought us Babe, Pig in the City, and what do you think it has on Rotten Tomatoes, AJ?
So I have a really distinct memory of when we did Happy Feet 2, right?
Well, yeah, with Annabelle.
I remember... with Annabelle King.
We were all sitting on the couch together.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah, I distinctly remember it.
Do you want me to finish? I remember talking about like that we were sleeping on George Miller as a voice for our podcast because we were a podcast that dissected sequels, and George Miller's sequels were always... really interesting or well received. Like, he seemed to understand how to do a sequel in a way that nobody else really did. And I remember at the time looking at Babe, Pig in the City and seeing it had a high Rotten Tomatoes score, and therefore I was justified in saying he makes good sequels.
Yeah.
That's all I know, but I reckon it's not as high as Babe 1. I reckon it's like maybe high 70s.
It is 65.
Okay, that's a lot lower than what I thought.
Yeah.
Never so mind. Fuck him.
Maybe
fuck
you don't.
George
maybe
Miller.
You don't remember it all
shit.
That well. Yeah. No. Yeah. This is a famous box office flop, critical disaster. Like 65 is relatively high for the way people talk about this film, sort of thing. It made
That is not how I've come to know it at all. Interesting.
Yeah, no,
okay.
I mean, yeah, it's people hate this film. So it made $69 million on a $90 million budget. Between this and the equally expensive Meet Joe Black, which also came out in 1998, the then head of Universal, Casey Silver, resigned because of this. Ron Meyer in 2011, who was the president and chief operating officer of Universal, told an audience in Savannah at Film Festival that Babe, Pig in the City was one of the two worst movies Universal has ever made. The other one he singled out was The Wolfman.
Interesting. I'm guessing he wasn't talking about the like Universal classic The Wolfman.
Yeah.
Surely he's not disparaging one of his like companies.
I know that you enjoyed this film, and you're not alone in that. And I will. Once you've given us the plot, I will tell you who's in your company with liking this film.
Okay, so this movie is about Babe accidentally. Basically, the farmer Hogger gets injured, and it's more or less Babe's fault. In a scene which
an insane opening to the film.
I was like, oh my god, they're going to kill off James Cromwell
in the most fucking Looney Tunes ass way. Like, yeah.
So yeah, he's like trying to get down a well, and then Babe falls in, and they have like a seesaw situation where
the counterweight and yada yada.
Yeah. I thought it was going to kill him. And yeah. I was like, Jesus Christ, that's so dark.
Yeah.
Like, this wonderful first film, and then start of the second one, you kill off Oscar nominated performance. I mean, to be fair, he's not in the film that much, though. Compared to the first one. What is the story engine?
They're
it's like because he's injured.
On the farm.
The bank has come to foreclose on the farm, and the only way to save it is for Babe to go to a sheepdog competition in the city?
There's like an appearance fee. But essentially because the city they need to go to, like they need to go to quote unquote the city, but they never get there.
Don't they?
No, because their connecting flight, they don't make their connecting flight because the
they
drunk
don't
dog,
make it to the city.
Yeah,
yes.
It's Bay Pig in a city, but it's not the intended city.
Yeah. So the drug dog voiced by Wallace Shawn. So the farmer's wife. No, it's Billy Crystal.
It's not Billy Crystal.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Still, but it sounds a lot like Billy Crystal.
No, don't tell me. It's not Billy Crystal. Who is it?
No, like it's someone doing a Billy Crystal impression. It's like his name's like Bill Cazzavalli or something. But I checked it as well because it sounds like Mike Wazowski, but it's not Billy Crystal.
Ah. Well, anyway, this drug dog, to show that when he barks, the humans come running in the airport. He barks around Babe, and they end up, him and Babe and the farmer's wife get detained in some other city where they have to shack up in a hotel. Babe gets kidnapped, makes friends with a bunch of other crazy animals in this hotel. It all culminates in a big showdown where they win the money and save the farm. I think the plot is the least interesting and also the least good element of this film. It's the least impressive, because what is impressive is much in the way that The Road Warrior, Beyond Thunderdome, Fury Road are all like catastrophically different movies to their predecessors respectively, right? Like I remember talking about this on the Mad Max episode, that George Miller cracked that the way to make a good sequel is to make a sequel that is unrecognizable to the first one. A sequel that cannot be compared. It does not invite comparison. And I was genuinely expecting like Ace Ventura 2, where instead of in the city, now it's in the wild. I was thinking it's the same thing, but instead of in the farm, now he's in the city. It's Babe, Pig in the City. Pig in the City as a sequel subtitle, I feel, has become one of these like generic shorthands for like a sequel that's got a gimmick, you know, this one's got a gimmick. But this movie is closer to Poor Things than it is to Babe One, I thought.
The aesthetic of the city's not dissimilar, yeah.
Yeah, the aesthetic of this, it looks like Batman Returns almost. Mm. Like, it is so imaginative, and there's this, it starts out and it feels like a sequel to Babe. It's all set on the farm. Then when they go to the city, it starts to get a little bit more eclectic. And then there's this really, what I'm assuming is a really famous shot from Babe, Pig in the City. I actually hadn't seen it before. And I put it on our Instagram as the we share photos of the movies we're watching to our Instagram, where Babe looks out the window of this hotel and it slowly pans past his head to show the skyline of the city, and it is every city you can think of. There is the Hollywood.
I'll read it out. Yeah. There you've got the it's an island similar to Manhattan that it takes place on, but it's got the World Trade Center, the Sears Tower, the Chrysler Building, the Empire State Building. All of those are in New York, so that's not that surprising. The IDS Center, the MetLife Building, the Sydney Opera House, the Hollywood Sign, the Golden Gate Bridge, the Furnasturm Berlin, Big Ben, St. Basil's Cathedral, Moscow's Red Square, the Statue of Liberty, the Eiffel Tower, the Christ the Redeemer statue, among others. And as a piece of dumb IMDb trivia points out, a helicopter and an airplane can be seen eerily close to the Twin Towers, although flying away from them.
Yeah, because it's never before had a image of the sky around the Twin Towers.
Yeah, a plane in it, yeah.
What's an airplane doing that? Yeah, so this moment happens, and I was like, oh, okay, this is a George Miller
He's
film.
In the city.
Like, this is this has got the same like world building nuances that made Fury Road so good, I thought. And the aesthetic, like it looks like those I Spy books, the where that guy would take like photos of these tableaus of and you have to spot different things. Like a more elegant Where's Wally kind of situation. Another movie it reminded me of was David Lynch's Dune. Like, everything in it is so from, like, a mind. It's not just... The first one's a storybook. This is a toy box.
A picture book.
You know, this is... Yeah, yeah. And, like at the end of the film, the climax of the film is the lady from Kath and Kim, whose name I can't pronounce. What's her name?
Magda Sabansky.
Magda Sabansky.
She was the spokesperson for Jetstar when it began, if you remember that.
No, I don't.
Low-cost airline.
Actually, now that you've said it.
Let's fly Jetstar.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my God. That was
They,
her.
Like, went all in on that when, New Zealand's low-cost airline. New Zealand and Australia, when it started, she was fucking everywhere.
I haven't thought about that in decades. Holy shit. But the climax is at this, I think it's at the place where they're trying to show off Babe. And she gets in like this giant jolly, no, she's in a clown suit for plot context reasons. And she like connects to like this strap on the roof and essentially like bungee jumps across this room trying to like chase the people who are stealing Babe or whatever boring plot that's completely overshadowed by the
animal
like
control
rich
officers.
And interesting... There you go, the rich and interesting, like, visual filmmaking at play. And, Richard, it's Thunderdome. We're watching Thunderdome, but with a clown instead of, like, a pseudo-sexual dominatrix guy, right? Like, it's the filmmaking language. Like, I always thought the joke was that, like, do you know the director of Mad Max also directed Babe, Pig in the City? And it's like, what? Those movies are so different. They're not. They're really similar movies. Like it is, there is a way to make this movie that I feel is what everyone who didn't like it is describing. This, like, boring, gimmicky, unnecessary sequel that, like, tarnishes the legacy of this like beautiful first film. I gave this 5 stars as well because I just thought it was so unexpectedly weird. The hotel that Babe is staying in is like dominated by monkey. There's monkeys in this one. I think one of them is voiced by Dennis Leary. Like they there's like
Stephen Wright.
It's Stephen Wright. It's totally Stephen Wright. Yeah. Like, there's just so much. They have babies, and Babe has to save the monkey babies, and there's this, like, angry orangutan whose heart is won over. Like, there's this bit where he saves a pit bull from drowning in what looks like the most animals were harmed in the making of this film thing I've ever seen. This pit bull is, like, hung from, like, its foot and dipped in this what looks like it's, like, maybe Amsterdam River,
like,
but obviously...
Venice. Sort of,
yeah. And it's just there. And we get, like, what made me think it was real is that there is a shot of the animals watching this happening while the pit bull itself is out of focus in the foreground. And you can see, much as the way with all the animals in Babe, you can see just his uncensored genitals, like, right there in front of the screen. Yeah. And I had this moment where I was like, either this is a real dog that they are dipping its head in water for the sake of the shot, or the puppet or whatever it is has hyper-realistic out-of-focus genitals right in front of the camera, right? And it must be that one. It must be the second thing. And Babe saves this pit bull, and the pit bull's like, now whatever the pig says goes. And of course, Babe being a little sweetheart.
Take the pig.
Babe essentially like creates harmony for a brief moment in the film between all the animals, and they all start singing If I Had Words, like that, and it's beautiful. It's genuinely I was like, this is so lovely and beautiful and gorgeous, and it breaks my heart to think that this was so trashed on by critics, because watching it now, it's like, it's one of these things which comes up a lot, I think, especially with auteur driven critical flops when you watch them now, now that we're in a sea
like
of films.
Something like Huey FOMO.
That wasn't a critical flop. Didn't have enough film, enough people watching it to be a critical flop.
That's not all it
turns out most viewed. but like it's you know, now like, oh, do I want to go see Godzilla X Kong, the new empire, or like whatever Marvel bullshit? Like these samey blockbusters, the most expensive TV shows in the world, no one's watching them, right? No one's watching Lord of the Rings. No one cares about The Mandalorian anymore, right? Like now we look back to the likes of like Batman and Robin, and we're like, ah, at least it was doing something. At least it like had style and flair, and genuinely that's how I feel. I think people just didn't get it. I don't think people were had an appetite for weird fucking movies in 1998, and now I think they do. And I think that this film, I don't think the story is like amazing, whereas that's kind of the best part of the first Babe, but the everything else in Babe, Pig in the City, so weird and so visionary and so interesting, and I had a fucking great time watching it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't like it as much as the original. I don't think it was the one of the two worst films Universal has ever made, but it's like the thing that I alluded to earlier is that like my, even though this goes bigger with the animals, like there's a bit where there's this adorable little kitten who keeps saying that it's hungry, and I just broke my little heart. I couldn't stand watching that. But also one thing, and I can say this now, I couldn't have said this last episode when we had Matt Stewart on, but I fucking hate like chimpanzees in movies. Like when it's actual monkeys or chimps or whatever being made to act out real things, I hate it. I've never enjoyed it. I don't think it's funny that like, oh look, it's acting like a human but it's an ape or whatever. And then having gotten older now, the like ethics side of it, I find even more off-putting. And so,
well, we should point out there is a very explicit no animals were harmed in the making of this film message in the credits. I noticed it says like any scene depicting injury was done with staging and puppets. And I think that's especially with what I was saying about the pit bull before. And I think like that, I don't know how, you know, do we just take that at face value and think that the chimps were treated fine? I don't know.
Well, that's maybe the thing. I mean, like I just think it's exploitative, and I just, I just don't enjoy watching it. There's like the little capuchin monkey Crystal, who's Annie's boobs from Community, was Dexter in Night at the Museum, like, and was in Hangover. That like I get Crystal, like I understand the appeal, and she seems to have had a good life, but I don't know. Yeah, there's just something like they just always look sad no matter what they're doing. They look, there was a TV show that used to be on, I think it was like a 5-minute interstitial type thing, but it was like monkeys running a hospital, and I hated it. Like even in this, because they can do so much more than a pig, because they can be trained and do something, they can wear little human clothes and stuff. They're made to do a lot more. Like you can get a pig or a dog or whatever to be like, okay, run here and stop, and we will animate your mouth, but the monkey is made to do so much more, and it just has the sad look on its face the whole time, and it makes me sad. I just don't like watching it. I don't find it funny, and also ethically I don't agree with it.
I think there couldn't have been a funnier time in the podcast for you to take this moral stance against using chimpanzees and monkeys in movies than one episode after we guest starred on a podcast specifically about primates and popular culture. I also think it's funny, and maybe worth exploring this, that this is an episode where the both of us have like questioned our own integrity when it comes to like ethical consumption of animals, right? Like we're both saying like we've got no excuse. We don't know what to say. We're sorry. Like I imagine we both feel the same, that we would both like to see us become like plant-based consumers by the end of our lives, right? I know I would anyway. Yeah. Like I would like to be a vegan at some point in my life. all of that, and then you're like, but I fucking hate the monkeys. God, I couldn't give a shit. Like, and I know you're saying it's because it's exploitative, but maybe it's also because, like, they are the closest to humans, which both of us hate. We both hate humans. Everyone hates humans, you know. So you'll see the closer they get to humans, the less sympathetic you get. And the less like with like, I'm sure there would have been cases on Babe One where, like, the duck wasn't treated particularly well, or, you know, just in the nature of how these things work. But, like, we still enjoy it because it's a cute little animal. But the monkey is so close to looking like a human that first thing you do is go, I hate this compared to the other animals. And then because you hate it, you're less attached, and that allows you to consider the exploitation aspect.
Well, I think it's part of it is that, like, watching, like, a modern, you know, like, I love Planet of the Apes, for instance, because that is all CG, and it's, and they emote a lot more than real, because you can't ask a monkey to, oh, you need a smile, give it, you know, give me a 10% sadder in this scene. But you have, like, in Babe, you can tell, in the original I'm talking about, you can tell when it's an animatronic, you can tell when it's a CGI mouth, you can tell all these things. And maybe it's even because it's better in the second one, that, you know, the technology is just that one step better, that there is less of, I know, just in my mind, the technology is not good enough that there was no animals near the scene of a drowning, you know. I can tell that there are some real animals involved in certain scenes, whereas you not can't necessarily know that for certain today. That it just I was a lot more uncomfortable watching this one, mainly because the monkeys make me sad.
No, I mean, fair enough. I think that this did play into one of the highlights of the film, though, which is when they get captured by animal control. The orangutan, who's, like, Scottish. Who's the orangutan played by? Because that's a... He's, like, the disapproving one that doesn't like Babe till the end of the film.
James Cosmo.
Okay, not a name I recognise. I keep expecting celebrity guest voices, but it's never one of them. So he's, like, disapproving of Babe the whole film. He's the one who's like, you can't let other animals into the hotel because there won't be enough to go around. And Babe sort of teaches them all socialism. And it turns out that everyone can have a jelly bean if it's all, you know, if it's all divvied out properly. And when they get captured by animal control, they're, like, planning their breakout. And they turn to the orangutan. They're like, you ready? And it's shot from, like, down the hall. He's in, like, the secluded part of his by himself, and he's putting on his clothing that he's been wearing the whole movie, and he just says, please wait, I'm not dressed. And he slowly gets dressed, and they wait for him, and he goes, thank you for waiting. And it was just this, that tugged at my heartstrings, because it's like, this is a character who has gone, this whole movie has been like the king of his little pile of dirt, right? Like, he's been at the top of it, and now he's just like, you know, now he's just a peasant. And it's like he's saying, allow me to keep my dignity. Mm. Allow me to get dressed before we go. I thought that was really, really well done.
I didn't dislike the film, but I much preferred the first one. But you are not alone, AJ, in your feelings for this film. The two most famous film critics of all time, Siskel and Ebert, both loved this film. Roger Ebert the film 4 out of 4 stars and said it was even better than the original. Here saying, Babe was a movie where everything led up to the big sheep herding contest. Babe, Pig in the City is not so plot bound, although it has the required assortment of villains, chases, and close calls. It is more of a wonderment, lolling in its enchanting images, original, delightful, and funny. He concluded, I liked Babe for all the usual reasons, but I like Babe, Pig in the City more, and not for any of the usual reasons, because here is a movie utterly bereft of usual reasons.
I love that, and that's exactly how I feel. But I will say, not very Ebertian to like a weird movie. Like, when I was on Do Go On the other week talking about 1984's Dune again, the David Lynch one, like, Ebert fucking hates that movie. Like, anything, like, I feel like a common trend, if you look back at a lot of Ebert's stuff, regardless of if we think the movie's good or bad, he really preferred traditional films over anything too expressionist, I felt.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But yeah, and Gene Siskel put it as his favorite movie of 1998. And it was his last ever favorite movie of the year because he died a couple months into 1999.
Oh my God, this is the movie so good it killed. What's Siskel's first name?
Gene.
Gene?
Yeah. It's like a reverse. Don't
the host.
The host. Fuck you.
Sorry. On the Zoom saying, delay, I said the host before you said don't tell me.
I always want to say I am number four, and I was like in my head, I was like, nope, it's not that one, it's the other one with the fucking blue eyes.
What are you talking about? Just to tell people
the
who
last,
don't know this
the last
reference.
Film that Roger Ebert reviewed and hated it so much that he died. But another fan of Babe, Pig in the City, are you familiar with Tom Waits?
Yeah.
So he's a big fan of the film. In a 2010 interview, he said, I'm not going to do his voice because it'll tear up my throat. But he said, you know what one of my favorite movies of all time is? And if I'm at home with my kids and say, what do you want to see? The big joke is, oh, Dad, not Pig in the City, but I love that movie. I'd see that anytime.
This is great. This is a great movie. And critics...
And if, like, of course, like Tom Waits is a lot more of your like weird fucking... weird guy that would like this movie for being weird.
I'm self-aware enough that I can stand back and I can go, I understand why this wouldn't have been for everyone. It's not what they expected. It's not what they probably bought a ticket for. But I'm just, I feel like this position that I'm in of like appreciating strange auteur driven messes, I feel like we are just going to find more and more reverence for those kinds of films we continue into blockbuster banality, you know, like as it all homogenizes until the same film is just released 20 times a year. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is going to films like this are going to be what we'll crave and what we missed. Look at what is getting nominated for best picture these days. It is the weird, it is the strange,
it's your maestros, because, it's your
yeah your Belfasts. No, but, you know, like Poor Things, Barbie, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, these are all like movies that like go they're chick flicks. they go against the grain in such a commanding way that I think even the most brand cereal tastes are starting to appreciate. You know, even if your favorite movie is like Transformers, I think that movies like Poor Things or Babe, Pig in the City are starting to demonstrate their value in a much more obvious way.
Hmm. Well, I disagree, but we'll move on. No, I don't. Anyway, we talked about titles briefly at the top, but worth mentioning, the original title for this film was Babe in Metropolis. And there's some signs up throughout the film that it's implied that that's the name of the city that he's in.
Interesting.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
Babe, Pig in the City's a better title.
Yeah, it's just one of those classics. It's like Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed, which just rolls off the tongue, which James Gunn recently said he didn't want to call it that. He just wanted to call it Scooby-Doo Unleashed. But no.
What's interesting about that is that the movie is specifically about the monsters being unleashed. Mm. Like, unambiguously, like the title wasn't just like it's not just like Scooby-Doo Reloaded. Mm.
It's
referring to something that happens in the film.
Having that, like, you want a Scooby-Doo... this time it's bigger and better in one word. Unleashed is a good dog pun, now that I think about it.
That's true. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. And is that the intention with Monsters Unleashed to begin with?
I guess
with?
It's one of those things that you and I always do on our private chat. Where
this is crazy! Is this not a crazy revelation?
I think that Monsters
that
Unleashed...
Scooby-Doo Unleashed is a dog pun?
I think Scooby-Doo Unleashed... is a great dog pun, but yeah, the joke that you and I love to make is Monsters Unleashed is now too removed from the pun, so it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, at least it took me 25 years to realize it was even, well, however old Scooby-Doo, 20, just 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah,
to realize that it even was, like, possibly even referring to that.
Wow. And you heard it here first.
It makes you think.
It does make you think, doesn't it? Well, anyway, a couple of siggies we've got to get through. We've got a ranked at franchise. Head over to letterboxd.com and, you know, so on.
We've got a list of all the franchises we've ever done, and we rank them. We also, Richard, typically do something called a gold star for when we think there is no obvious weak point in a franchise. It sometimes gets conflated with all of them are as good as each other, which I don't think is entirely correct. I think it just means there's like no obvious bad one. Mm. And it's a little bit different with two film franchises because I feel like it's like less impressive if there's two good films in a row. Yeah. And I will also concede that clearly the critical consensus is not with me enough to give Babe a gold star franchise.
I wouldn't have even
I will say that even if it was well received at the time, I do think that there is a bespoke difference with with my feelings for how good the Babe films are compared to like how good the Before trilogy is, right? Where Babe is a series, I think, where it's, for me anyway, it's a case of two really good movies, but cohesiveness is, the cohesiveness isn't there at all. I actually don't think this is a good franchise, just on paper.
Do you think it's
two really, really strong films.
Do you think it's better than Phantasm?
Yeah.
Okay, do you think it's better than Popstar?
Yeah, okay, you need to jump up a few. I reckon we're above Nymphomaniac Constant. I don't think we'd get any like pushback for that.
Is it better than Frozen?
I guess now we're getting into a matter of taste, aren't we?
Mm.
Because I would say Babe is a better movie than Frozen and Frozen 2, right? I'd say Babe, Pick of the City, is better than Frozen
2. Okay, well, here's the real question. Is it better than Happy Feet?
Yeah, I think it's better than Happy Feet.
Okay.
What do you think?
I don't have any thoughts. Is it better than... Trying to find our next two-film... Is it better than Kill Bill?
Let's put it, what's below Kill Bill?
Fast and the Furious.
I reckon it's between Fast and Furious and Kill Bill, maybe.
Okay. That is our,
I don't know, like, what,
it's our new,
what do you
36.
Think? I'm genuinely curious. Because 36 was lower than what I was planning.
I would have put it lower than Phantasm.
Really?
No, I'm being a silly goofball. No, I don't care.
I feel like Kill Bill gets the edge because it has the like cohesiveness that the Babe franchise.
Well, it's also arguably only
but
one
also,
movie. What about is it better than Monsters
but
Inc.?
But then is see now this is what I'm saying is like now go above Kill Bill. What's one above Kill Bill?
Evil Dead.
Very similar franchise to well at least. Sam Raimi and George Miller are similar directors,
yeah,
I think.
And then above...
Yeah, no, I'm... Let's, yeah. What? No, you go. I'm always keen to stay in the ranking segment for as long as possible.
Above that is Casino Royale. Above that is Mad Max.
No, okay. I think we're one below Kill Bill at
36. Cool.
I think 36. That's a good place for that.
All right, and now we've got to continue the franchise. AJ, do you have a continuation of the franchise? Where would you like to see the Babe franchise go?
Well, first of all, I would like to acknowledge how... I don't know if there's been a duology ever that's asking less for a third entry than the Babe series. Like, this just feels so complete and it doesn't need anything more. Whereas, like, I wouldn't necessarily say that about other two film franchises such as Kill Bill or Monsters, Inc., the two you mentioned that are in front of mind right now. But here is my sequel pitch, and it goes back to the origins of the podcast and even a little bit earlier, Richard, to The Muppet Show. Let's get Babe Pigs in Space for a few reasons. One, because I liked the Pigs in Space and that it sounds like Pig in the City. It sounds like where you'd go next, right? And also classic Culpepper joke doing in space sequels. On top of that, as ridiculous as it might sound off the bat, I don't think it's that out of the question that Babe would find himself at Cape Canaveral or something and have some
I think that's completely out of the question.
I think after Pig in the City, Babe can do anything now.
After
Babe
going to the city, where else is there to go?
Space! That's what I'm saying. And I think like Babe, Pig in the City establishes that this is like
this is a pig who will go anywhere.
This is a melodramatic universe in which the films are set.
Yeah, sure.
And perhaps it's done like from the perspective of the animals. Perhaps the point is like a farm is so quaint and traditional and that's all they know. And when they go to the city, it's just stimulation overload. And the way they comprehend it is in this like gothic kind of like, you know, comic book classic kind of way. What's the word I'm looking for? It's like an architectural style.
Postmodernism.
No, like there's a it's the big one. What's the big architectural style?
Architecture. Do you want me to ask Jess studied architecture for you?
Jess?
Yeah.
What's the big architectural style? What's the big architectural style? Like the big one, you know?
She said postmodernism. Tell her I was thinking of Art Deco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I heard that. She agrees. That's one of the big ones. there's an Art Deco style to the city that the pig is in.
Yeah.
And I guess, like, knowing how ridiculous that movie allows itself to get, I could see a Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars situation happen for Babe, you know?
Yeah. I want to see, thank you for that, AJ. I want to see, I was thinking that like Babe kind of lends itself due to the time period and the subject matter to like a cartoon series. And you could just have the adventures of the farm. You could keep the same voice actor even. And yeah, it's like a sheep pig. The series would be called Babe the Sheep Pig, and it'll be like, yo, all these crazy adventures it gets into. But then the thing that I would really want to see is this imaginary TV series, and then cross it over so that you have a reason to bring back a beloved show from my childhood, Sheep in the Big City.
Sheep in the Big City. This is, I'm so glad we share this because I feel like I don't know anyone else who knows, except maybe my younger sibling who knows Sheep in the Big City. Genuine, to this day, one of the funniest kids' cartoons ever made.
It's incredible.
Like, it is so funny.
I think it's all on YouTube, or a lot of it's on YouTube. It's fucking fantastic.
It's from like 2005. It's so self-aware. It feels like a predecessor to like the meta sense of humor that dominated in years past, right? Like it was like full of like fictional ads that would play in between the sections.
And the narrator was like an active character in it. But he was like the narrator. And it would just cut to his recording booth and then...
And the bad guy was an army general named General Specific, and his sidekick was Private Public.
They had this
crazy like Frankenstein scientist who was not a mad scientist. He was an angry scientist. Yeah. They would go out of his way to clarify that whenever it came up.
And the reason they were going after him is because they had a sheep-powered ray gun, which is like just this giant ray gun with a sheep-shaped hole cut out of it. And so they had to try and capture the sheep so it could fit in.
Do you remember what happened in the two seasons? Do you remember what happened in the season one finale of Sheep in the Big City?
They get the narrator-powered gun, right?
There's a narrator-powered ray gun, and the narrator gets captured and put in the ray gun, and then it reveals who the true mastermind is, and the swivel chairs turns around, and Sheep is the bad guy the whole time. And then this was just promptly abandoned when season two started, like it was just back to status quo. But like the first season ended with the reveal that Sheep in the Big City was the bad guy, and the narrator was actually wanted for a narrator-powered ray gun. God! So good, so funny, such a good show.
We should do a Sheep in the Big City rewatch podcast.
Yeah, we'll call it AJ and Richard in the Big City with the Sheep in the Big City.
Someone make a thumbnail for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyway,
thank you.
Yeah, we now have to reveal what our next two film franchise will be, AJ.
Oh, and is this a franchise roulette?
It is, situation? And I believe it's your time to make me guess if you want to.
I will. I'll pull up our franchise list. So if you've never heard the show before, I laugh because who the hell's listening who isn't already? We choose the next franchise by randomly drawing from a list of franchises. This year we're only doing two film franchises, so we'll draw a random number and that'll correspond to a franchise. Richard, give me a number.
94.
Two film franchise 94, Richard, is, this is a franchise which had a sort of it's a distant sequel situation. Mm-hmm. The first one, quite a revered film, and I believe the second one, which I was really excited to see, but I never saw it, also isn't like poorly reviewed at all. Mm. I think it was it had quite good reviews. An adult, very much more adult-oriented
it's
than...
It's Trainspotting, isn't it?
It's Trainspotting. Trainspotting and T2. Trainspotting. So that's what we'll do. What a cool franchise to get. I'm looking forward to that. Finally an excuse to watch Trainspotting 2.
Your most anticipated movie of 2016.
So thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you enjoyed this, Twitter, Instagram, we're all on there. We're also jumping in the Discord if you want to tell us that you too have this burning
too?
Love for Bay Pig in the City.
W-E-2.
Ah, they're very nice. And you can also donate to our Patreon over at patreon.com/ColePopshire if you wish to do so. You can get all sorts of things there, like exclusive extra podcasts, and you get to tell us suggest and vote on every second franchise we cover, and give us something to talk about after the music you're currently hearing ends.
I just dropped a new Dix tape on there. People have been listening along to that.
Are you doing the segment Dick's Picks yet?
I didn't. I forgot to do it last time, and then I deliberately didn't do it this time.
Fantastic. I respect your creative vision. So check that out over at patreon.com/ColePopshire, and stay tuned after this music ends for the post-credits scene. Thank you very much for listening. I love talking about this. This was such a fun franchise to get
I just
into
like
the,
spending time
get
with
into
you,
the trough.
So it doesn't matter what we're talking about.
Welcome along to the post-credits scene. There's a segment at the end of each episode. If you donate $5 or more over at patreon.com/ColePopshire, you get to give us something to talk about in this, the post-credits scene. Richard, who's it from and what is it?
Today's post-credits scene is one of many sent in by Bitmore Cheese, who sent a massive list to you about 18 months ago. And then when we said, hey, we've run out of things, he came out of the woodwork and said, I sent in a bunch and you haven't used any of them. And then I was like, oh, what's this? And then he sent them to me about a month or two ago, and then I forgot to put them on the list. But they're on there now.
The idea, it's not that I forgot. It's that like I'm trying to space
it
out
so
that we're not just
give a shit
answering the same person.
No, these were never added episode to the list at all until I did.
Bitmore Cheese, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you just said, hey, why are you sending me a bunch of questions? I don't give a shit about you. Those sort of things.
Your cheese.
Yeah.
If anything, there could be less cheese.
So Bitmore Cheese says, hey, Shaggers. It's been said that there is one sandwich you're still thinking about to this day. What's that dream sandwich? What's inside it? Where were you when you had it? And would you try to recreate that experience?
Do you have a long answer for this question?
I can adjust my length accordingly.
I have quite a long, passionate, emotional answer for this question.
Okay.
But I worry that two really long answers is too much. So
you go first.
Okay. When I was 17, my family tried to move to Australia and I stayed in New Zealand to such a long context for the story to finish off school. And the end of the story is that they came back because it wasn't working out.
Do we need to hear all this?
Before I even went over. Just in case people are like, well, did you go to Australia? So I had to stay with this family from my church. And they were the exact kind of people, they're not going to listen to this, so I'm sure they won't mind me saying this. They're the exact kind of people who probably shouldn't take in an angsty teenager who's mad at his parents and everything. I felt like the mother of this family especially was very hands-on, and I really needed hands-off like relationships in my life at that point, I think. But anyway, the 2 months I stayed at this house are full of like just feeling really lonely and pressured, and a lot of really dark memories. But the one thing I did get from this is my parents for some reason never made me cook, and this woman made me cook. She taught me how to cook, and I have a formative memory of being 17 and putting chicken in a frying pan and seeing it turn white after it got hot from the pan, and being like, I've never done that before. Like, I've never seen myself do that to chicken before. And they used to make me this sandwich, and here's what I think the sandwich had from memory. It was a piping hot toasted ciabatta roll that was open, so it was like a pocket, not like two pieces cut in half, more like open, and they'd pulled some of the breading out and so that you could put stuff in there. In the sandwich itself was piping hot chicken, raw capsicum, and brie cheese that would just turn to cream from the heat of the chicken and the bread combined. It is to this day, Richard, and Bit More Cheese, and friends of the Discord and the podcast listening, the best thing I've ever eaten. So delicious. Just so good. And I can still remember the way all the flavors combined into. I remember sitting on an armchair eating it, thinking about how miserable my life is, and being like, but this sandwich kind of makes up for a lot of what's going wrong in my life right now.
You've made one for me.
Have tried to recreate it thousands of times. Me and my friend once, we named it the Allison Brie, but if you swapped chicken for steak, it was the Brie Larson. Or no, it was the other way around. I think the Allison Brie was the steak and the Brie Larson was the chicken. And I would start incorporating like relishes and chutneys, all sorts of new things. Now, don't get me wrong, I've made some pretty fucking awesome Brie Larson sandwiches over the years. Like, they're great and I'm proud of them and they're delicious. I've never gotten it exactly right. It's like their Principal Skinner joke about the could never get the spices right here in the States. Like, it's like I'm making delicious chicken Brie sandwiches. They're great. But they're not. I stay up at night wondering if I missed an ingredient, you know, if I've forgotten like a crucial part of the process, because I didn't make these sandwiches. They made them for me.
Probably just need a bit more cheese.
Also, funny to be like waxing lyrical about a chicken sandwich on an episode where we were talking about how like we are so desperate to become vegans. We feel this distinct calling to give up eating meat. And then the post-credit scene, I'm like, I had an emotional experience with a chicken sandwich that I will never get over.
Yeah, my like two answers to this. One is just like, there's a sandwich shop in Auckland now that I've taken you to, and it's fucking incredible.
Oh, great
and
place.
It's like so a
good
deli, New York deli sort of style. Fucking incredible sandwiches there. It's like, it's quite out of my way to get there now, but I'm willing to do it. But the other one, I won't.
Place is called Pastrami on Rye for those.
Pastrami and Rye.
And Rye.
But the other thing, the closest sort of thing to what you said is that when I was in Scotland as a kid.
In Scotland? Yes, you've told me this. I think you've said it on the podcast before, but it's a great story.
But it's one of these, like, I love asking people what the best thing they've ever eaten is, because, I mean, it's very boring if you're like, oh, you know, just this restaurant that I go to, I love it. Like, the best answers are like the specific thing your mum made. Like something like that, where it's like, I've never been able to replicate it, or a restaurant that you could never find again in a million years. And my example is one of those. It's like, we were in Scotland and I would have been 9, and it was like an alleyway off an alleyway off an alleyway. We found this little tiny hole in the wall in the middle of nowhere. Me and my sister got bacon baps. So like a bap, you know, being the type of a roll. And it was just like, just bacon straight. I'm pretty sure.
This
maybe
is the funniest story to be telling on the baby
episode. I know. But then, and my mum got mac and cheese. I can't remember what my dad got, or if he got anything. But all three of us were like, this is the best thing I've ever had in my life. And it was like one of those things where it was just such a simple, it was like literally just straight bacon. And like, I fucking love a BAP. Like, don't get me wrong, I love a BAP. But yeah, it was, it I wouldn't even be able to tell you what city we were in. And then, you know, to narrow that, there was, and it's been over 20 years. There is no way that place is still there. So I just couldn't recreate it.